Acts 20, the first 12 verses. When the uproar had ended, Paul sent for the disciples, and after encouraging them, said goodbye and set out for Macedonia. He travelled through that area, speaking many words of encouragement to the people, and finally arrived in Greece, where he stayed 3 months. Because some Jews had plotted against him just as he was about to sail for Syria, he decided to go back through Macedonia. He was accompanied by Sopater, son of Pyrrhus from Berea, Aristarchus and Secundus from Thessalonica, Gaius from Derbe, Timothy also, and Tychicus and Trophimus from the province of Asia. These men went on ahead and waited for us at Troas, but we sailed from Philippi after the festival of unleavened bread, and 5 days later joined the others at Troas, where we stayed 7 days. On the first day of the week, we came together to break bread, and Paul spoke to the people because he intended to leave the next day, kept on talking until midnight. There were many lamps in the upstairs room where we were meeting. Seated in a window was a young man named Eutychus, who was sinking into a deep sleep as Paul talked on and on. When he was sound asleep, don't comment, please. When he was sound asleep, he fell to the ground from the third story and was picked up dead. Paul went down, threw himself on the young man and put his arms around him. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "He's alive." Then he went upstairs again and broke bread and ate. After talking until daylight, he left. The people took the young man home alive and were greatly comforted. Jesus took a group of strange mix of people. Professional fishermen, middle-class people, working-class people. Some who got on with the Romans, some who hated the Romans. He worked with them for 3 years, and then he let them loose. But very soon he then picked on a guy who was the most Christian-hating, Gentile-loathing man on the planet, called Saul. And he met him on the road to Damascus. He said, "Saul, tell you what, firstly, you're going to preach about me all around the world, and secondly, you're going to preach about me to the Gentiles." And this guy who loathed Gentiles, loathed Christians, very soon was preaching about Jesus to non-Jews. And the church grew, and it grew quickly, and we're following its growth. And this passage we've read is unlike any other. It's a phenomenal passage, which shows us the power and strength and vigor and growth of the early church. And how did God do that? He put steel into the faith of those early Christians. I came across it in somebody else's sermon, that phrase, steel in your faith, and I loved it. Put steel into the faith of these people who are under pressure. And he used this group of people to change the world. And there's no passage like this one that shows it. Now, before we get into that, I want to show you a video clip. Real Madrid, I don't usually use sporting analogies, but Real Madrid this last year has been the most successful team in the world. They won the European Champions Cup, and they won the Spanish Cup, but they couldn't do it without the help of a Welshman. And this is, they won the Cup final 1-0, and this is Gareth Bale winning the Cup for them. Gareth Bale is from Cardiff, was spotted at the age of 9 years of age by the Southampton scouts, who signed in for Southampton, and he stayed with Southampton until he was 15. When he was 15, Southampton decided to let him go. They didn't want him anymore. At the age of 11, Gareth had been the second fastest runner over 50 metres in Wales. By the time he was 15, he was getting outpaced by a young guy called Theo Walcott, who was also in the squad. The reason was that Gareth had gone through a 6-inch growing spell in 12 months, and it took him 3 years to get his speed back. But the scout persuaded Southampton to keep him on the books because he believed this guy was going to do great things. So the Southampton management took the advice, kept him on the books, and at age of 18, Gareth was sold to Spurs, where the manager, Harry Redknapp, decided to keep him in the reserve team for 2 years, and the place in the first team was given to a man called Benoit Assou-Ekotto. No, I don't remember him either. And then he was injured, and they put Gareth Bale on, and the rest is history. At which point would you have given up on Gareth Bale? The guy made it through because one or two people believed in him, believed that he had talent and could go on to be a great footballer. And that's what I want to talk about this morning. Effective discipleship can be measured. I've only got 2 points this morning, but the first is this. Effective discipleship can be measured. Let's put up my favorite verse in this passage on the screen, the one that you yawned at when we read it. It's accompanied by Sopater and Aristarchus and Secundus and Gaius, and you all went, yeah, get on with it, get on with the story. But actually, this is the story. These guys are the story. These guys are what the book of Acts is all about. This is the heart. This is all about steel in your faith. Paul didn't begin his first missionary journey, we're not sure of the timing, but about 46 AD. He started his second missionary journey in 49 AD, his third missionary journey in 53 AD. And we're now maybe 56, 57 AD. The churches at this point are most 10 years old. Some of the churches that Paul planted are still only 6 or 7 years old. He left Ephesus after a riot, spent 3 months traveling around the coast, decided to go back to Jerusalem to take an offering back to Jerusalem, but he found some of the Jews were arguing against him. He didn't fancy spending a long sea journey on a ship with people who were out to kill him. You can't blame him. So he went the long way around by land and then took a shorter trip. It should have been a 3-day trip, but the winds were against him, so it took 5 days, and he ends up in Troas, where the others who went on the ship meet with him. Okay? So the team splits up. Paul takes the long route round. They meet up in Troas. They're on their way to Jerusalem, and we will be following them on the trip to Jerusalem. But I want you to take a look at these names. And they might not mean anything to you, but let's go through them as quickly as we can. There's going to be a lot of Bible flicking at this point, a lot of verses on the screen. Time's against us, so bear with me. We're going to go through it. Aristarchus is a posh name, okay? Aristarchus is a posh name. If he was modern, he might be called Crispin or something like that. I don't know. George. He'd be George today, wouldn't he? Aristarchus... I'm starting with him, because there's quite a lot about him in the Bible. He had a frightening experience in chapter 19, verse 29. The city was in uproar, and the mob seized Gaius and Aristarchus. This is a guy who looked death in the eye. He was very nearly lynched by an angry mob, though he'd done nothing wrong. In fact, the mob didn't know what he'd done, but they seized him anyway. Frightening experience. He was to join Paul on a trip to Rome. If you flick through to chapter 27, verse 2, a few years later, we boarded a ship from Adramyttium, about to sail for ports on the coast of the province of Asia, and he put out to sea. Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica, was with us. He joins Paul on that sea trip, gets shipwrecked halfway round, ends up in the sea, and washes ashore on the island of Malta. And he's nearly drowned, but he survives. That's quite an exciting life for a man who's been brought up in a very respectable middle-class home. He's in Rome with the Apostle Paul when the Apostle Paul writes a letter to Philemon, verse 24 of Philemon. Epaphras, my fellow prisoner in Christ Jesus, sends you greetings, and so do Mark, Aristarchus, Demas, and Luke. So he's with Paul in Rome. He's got there. And in Colossians 4, verse 10, my fellow prisoner Aristarchus sends his greetings. Somehow or other, he's got himself arrested in Rome, and he's in prison with Paul. He's a tough guy. He's had a very checkered life, very exciting life since he accepted Jesus in his heart, since he received Jesus. There's a tradition, unconfirmed, that he was martyred by Nero a few years after this, but we don't know for sure. Go to Secundus. Secundus is a slave name, and Secundus was the second slave in a household. Guess what the first was called? Primus. There you go. Easy. He was a slave. We don't know more about him than that. Go on to Sopater. Sopater was son of Pyrrhus from Becca, and it turns out we think it's him in Romans 16:21, where he's called Sosipater. Ancient Greek names often had several versions of their spelling. But it looks like he comes from Berea and ends up in Rome with Paul. Then we go on to Gaius from Derbe. Gaius might have been baptized by Paul, but not sure. 1 Corinthians 1:14, it was a common name. Paul says, I'm thankful I did not baptize any of you except Crispus and Gaius. Was it the same Gaius who was baptized by Paul? We're not sure. And Paul is staying with a Gaius in Rome, Romans 16:23. Gaius, whose hospitality and the whole church he enjoys, sends you his greetings. Is it the same Gaius? We don't know for sure. But he came from Derbe. You still with me? You go on to Timothy. You know all about Timothy. Acts 16, verse 1. Paul picks him up in his team in Lystra, where a disciple named Timothy lived, whose mother was a Jewess and a believer, but whose father was a Greek. We know quite a lot about Timothy because two letters of the New Testament were written to him by Paul. The last two letters Paul wrote, he wrote to Timothy. And Timothy, we know, became one of the outstanding ministers and pastors in the early church. Tychicus. There are five mentions of Tychicus in the New Testament. I'm just picking up one. Ephesians 6:21. Tychicus, the dear brother and faithful servant in the Lord, will tell you everything, so that you also may know how I'm doing what I'm doing. Tychicus is going from church to church, preaching, taking messages from the Apostle Paul. He's become a key player in the early church from Asia Minor. There's an ancient text that suggests he was from Ephesus. And last but by no means least, Trophimus from Asia Minor. He was an Ephesian. Acts 21:29. They had previously seen Trophimus the Ephesian in the city. He's got to Jerusalem at this point and assumed that Paul had brought him into the temple area. So we know we find Trophimus in Jerusalem. And in 2 Timothy 4, verse 20, Erastus stayed in Corinth and I left Trophimus sick in Miletus. And the last we know of Trophimus is ill in Miletus. But we don't know more than that. Now, you're saying, yes, name's Peter, but wait a minute. Wait a minute. How old were the churches? None of these churches these guys came from was older than 10 years. Some of these churches were only 7 years old. And yet already, these churches have thrown up a generation of leaders who, within the next 10 or 15 years, we find these guys spread all over the Roman Empire, preaching about Jesus, ministering in the churches, doing a great work for job. Those small churches that we've seen born during these studies, little groups of people, handfuls of people, have thrown out a generation of leaders that is going to set the foundation for 2,000 years of church growth. There are 2 billion people on this planet who claim to know Jesus as their Savior. And it all comes down to this generation of young men who'd been Christians less than 10 years when we meet them in a story. Within a few years, had been thrown up out of the churches and had become leaders. Effective discipleship can be measured. How effective was the discipleship program of those early churches? It put steel in their faith. You can measure the effectiveness of the discipleship of a church by what the people from that church do. And these guys changed the world. Effective discipleship produces good teams. If you go on to verses 6 and 7, we find the team sticks together. The team gets together at Troas, and we stayed 7 days. Remember, this is a team of 6 or 7 of these guys who are on the journey together, preaching and ministering together. And effective discipleship also sees extraordinary results. If we go on to verses 9 to 10, we see wherever Paul was and where these guys were, miracles happen. And we see a miracle of this guy. Now, at this point, most ministers, every sermon I've ever heard plunges into cheap jokes about people falling asleep in church, and I swore I would not do that. That's cheap. Everybody does it. I've heard all the jokes before. I said, I am not going to do that until I came across this video on the internet.
One too many boring sermons? Dry eyes? Or do you find it all so dull that you just want to give up and die? Well, we have just the product for you. Introducing the all-new Face Slapper Pro. Just pop it on your head and let it do its work. Never again will you fall asleep in a sermon, no matter how boring the preacher is. This is not a real product, and WordLive do not endorse it.
Steel in your soul. A friend of mine was pastoring a church in the interior of Brazil, and one of his leaders was working in a field with a guy who was a staunch Roman Catholic, and he used to have sparking debates about theology, these two guys. And they're working in the field one day, and his Roman Catholic theological sparring partner suddenly keeled over, flat on his back, stopped breathing with his eyes wide open. And my friend, this is church member, said, I'm going to get blamed for this, because they all know we're always arguing. And he said, in Jesus' name, stand up. And he said, suddenly the guy shot upright, gasping like a deer caught in headlights, looking around totally bewildered what had happened. Steel in his faith. Steel in your faith. The boy Eutychus, Luke was a doctor, so Paul mentions that the boy was found dead, and then they prayed and he went back into the meeting. Effective discipleship produces good teams that have extraordinary results. It's all about people doing great things for Jesus, being trained for it. An acquaintance of mine, the Welsh Church over in northeast Wales, in Llansannan, pastoring a church mainly of elderly people, but he felt the call to train young people. He set up a course called Down, which in Welsh means a gift. It's a training course for young Welsh men and women. And it was just a simple course with not much structure. And now, out of that course, we have a generation of young, mostly men, ministers across Wales. Chris Lloyd, who's preacher, is one of them. And you look at that little church that was church of elderly, mainly elderly people, and you see these young men going out. This is a new generation of leaders, and you think that actually is what this passage is all about. This passage is about the greatest miracle of all. It's taking people off the street and turning them into Christian leaders and putting steel in their faith so they can go and change the world. Forgive me, I'm elderly. I have a bus pass. I'm that old. So I can say this, what I'm going to say, without fear of offense of ageism, all right? As I travel around Wales, I see the big problem, and the big problems is that many churches, perhaps most of the churches, are geared to be run by elderly people to make elderly people comfortable. Now you compare that to what we're seeing in this book of Acts. Nobody's comfortable. And there are elderly leaders. There are elderly leaders being discipled and growing. It's not all about age. But what these guys are doing is they are transforming. They're changing people. They're changing people. They're making people grow. And if you look at chapter 20, verse 2, it says, Paul traveled through the area speaking many words of encouragement to the people. He spent his time encouraging the people, encouraging churches, putting steel into people's faith so they change the world. That surely is our challenge, our greatest challenge as a church, is to take the people who come, there's so many people come through our doors, to put steel in their faith and send them out into the world. And thank God there are all around the world people who've been discipled in this church at the moment. But that's our job. That's our calling. And that's what God's calling us to do.